Okay, so, guess it's five. Not sure what's happening with people not being here. So today we're going to talk about ASIC accelerators. So we had a paper on, oh right, that's what that did. And I'm, come on, there, okay. And we had a paper on making an accelerator for neural networks, and also a paper on a tool that the same authors developed and therefore hyped, overlapping set of authors, for making it allegedly easier to evaluate accelerator designs. So the motivation for everything which talks about accelerators is the end of the physics people figuring out how to solve all our performance problems for us and just making everything faster. Which has lots of names, but essentially it's just that the physics people aren't actually solving, are actually going to make things faster for free, which was the experience if you were talking about CS in the 90s, in which case people just assumed, oh, computers are going to continue getting faster for the foreseeable future. So the solution is specialization as the way to improve performance. And this is particularly good and usually comes up in these papers about performance per watt. So energy efficiency of the computation rather than just raw how much work are you getting done per unit time. And this is something that customization helps you a lot more for because all the things we've done to increase performance that increase complexity tend to increase power consumption, even if they do make things faster. So everything we do in superscalar processors, we have logic, renaming logic, we have dependency checking logic that all takes power, even if it doesn't affect the computation speed. Everything we do in GPUs to have more memories and things like that takes power, it's not as bad. But the real gain is from performance per watt more than absolute performance. And these papers generally aren't talking about performance per dollar, which is an interesting question. And sort of the challenge that these people are facing is how do we actually effectively, take advantage of the specializations on one side. On the other side, how do we make it practical to do this for new problems? Because probably we don't actually think that if we just solve neural networks, everyone's going to be happy and they aren't going to have any other high-speed computational needs, and we're done. That they're going to think that people are going to come with new problems and we're going to want to solve them, and we aren't going to want to go through some very intensive development effort every time we have a new variation of something to do. So I'm going to start off with the Aladdin paper, probably, and then we'll move on to the Minerva paper. So before I start, any general comments on what people thought about the Aladdin paper? This is the paper on the system for modeling performance. Things people liked or didn't like about it. Yeah?
I was sort of surprised by the accuracy of your estimations. If they're that accurate, it feels cycle accurate, and what's the point of even having like an RTL simulator?
So it's surprisingly accurate. So what were they missing in their estimates? What did they use to This is basically, if I read the paper correctly, what they were modeling to get their estimates of power and area. Basically said, okay, we have a bunch of functional units, which are analogous to functional units in a normal superscalar processor, and we need to know how much power they take up. And we have some memory that these need to access, and we know how much power that takes up. And I believe that was essentially everything they used. So what's missing from this that could affect power of the system? I/O. So they didn't care about I/O. That's not included in their power estimates. What else? If you're puzzling for what to think about, you should think about what's in a superscalar processor that's not on this list. That might take up power. Which would be like anything in a superscalar processor. So in our gem processor, what were our stages? So we had fetch. Does that come up here? No, because we don't have instructions anymore. We are always executing the same instruction all the time, conceptually. Mostly? Well, that's a good question. Do we have instructions in the system? So here's what they're imagining the computation is like. That we have functional units being used at each point in time. And that's what Aladdin is simulating. So Aladdin is producing this trace on the right side of saying, at first cycle, we're using one adder. In the second cycle, we're using four memory read-write units. In the third cycle, we're using two adders. That's the sort of information they're producing. So this indicates that we aren't always doing the same thing every cycle. So what needs to happen in order for us to be able to do that? It's going to need to be in this chip. So how are we going to decide which of these we do? What would be a way you might implement that? How do we know? How is the thing we manufacture going to know that I need to do four memory operations in this cycle? So
I guess it does like a local processor.
So yeah, we're gonna need some logic, something that looks kind of like a little processor that doesn't execute a real instruction set, but has some notion of something about a current thing to do, a current instruction. So these aren't like full-fledged processors with general purpose instruction sets, but we still need to have control logic of some sort, with some sort, something kind of like a little program to run, and a little logic to iterate through that program and know which instruction we're on and how to execute, do that individual step. This is a lot simpler than a general purpose CPU, because our instructions are basically, you know, only these choices. Oh, so it's very constrained, so it should be simpler, but we still need that control logic. And all the that things. And that is not on here. We aren't modeling that. We're just assuming, Aladdin is just assuming that that's negligible relative to what is accounted for already in the benchmarks they have for cost to memory and seeing how fast, how efficient the functional units are that they got from their micro benchmarks. So we're missing both I/O, all the logic to actually move data onto this accelerator and off, and also to move data between different parts of the accelerator. And we're also missing this control logic. So the remarkable thing that you were surprised by here is that despite omitting all of this from their model, that they actually got pretty good estimates of performance. So, do we think that this is something that they just got lucky? Is this something which is generally true of these problems? Like, what's going to be a factor that makes this work or not work? So one way to start is, would this work, would the same technique work if we were talking about the performance of a superscalar processor, the power usage?
No.
No, why not?
Well, your power that you consume is gonna be going to more than just primarily memory and function. It's, mm-hmm. You're doing a lot more stuff.
Yeah, so on a general purpose processor, our control logic is really complicated relative to our functional units. And that takes up a real lot of power. So we can't just model the performance of our local, our memories, which on our processor are caches, and sort of what functional units actually get used and expect to actually know what the power consumption is. Because as we know from like looking at how much area of the processor is taken up by the control logic, it's definitely a lot of the circuitry. And it's most likely it's going to be a lot of the power. There's a lot of actual work done in the process, how the processor determines what functional units to use. And the assumption here is that this is negligible. So Aladdin's assuming that if you're making an accelerator that you're going to fit in this case where this is what the functional unit power and the memory power are what actually dominate your power consumption and your area usage. And we can imagine cases, you can at least construct cases where this isn't true. So if something looks like a normal processor, that's not going to be the case anymore. And modeling the power is going to be a lot more complicated because you actually need to reason about how complicated is this control logic that we need, that Aladdin just decides we don't need to care about yet. And you also might run into problems, I would imagine, if these were both very small. So what would Aladdin look like if we wanted to model our regular expression processor? What would the functional units for that be? It'd be, yeah. Okay, so the functional units would be the things on the transition table. So it doesn't fit nicely into our normal model. So yeah, we have our, what we had before is we represented our linear expression as a graph, and we had like literal registers in here, which is, and we had like a comparator for some input here to determine what would happen. So our functional units are these comparators, I guess. For this sort of design, we don't actually have a natural way of using Aladdin. It doesn't fit onto this notion of having a something where we have obvious functional units to use if we're doing that sort of mapping. And so there seems to be some sort of assumption about what your applications look like that you're writing accelerators for, that they fit into this model. And since I'm sure people just skimmed it, let's go into like what this actually means, this complicated, impressive graph. So talk generally about high-level synthesis. So that's, the paper is based on this idea that you take something like C-like code, so there's a family of tools which take something like C-like code and produce hardware. And the problem with these tools, according to the paper, I don't know whether this is really true, and I'm sure there's dispute on that, is that you need that these tools are usable for actually producing real hardware. People use them in the real world for producing hardware. But when they do so, they take their C-like code and they tune it a lot. So they figure out how to change that code from what they would write to actually do the computation on their machine, you know, a normal processor, to make sure the dependencies aren't there and make the memory accesses already efficient. So they need to actually rearrange the code so it's obvious enough to the tool which is producing the hardware how to actually construct control logic that's efficient. If they don't, they get control logic which is excessively conservative. And the Aladdin paper has a basic idea of what apparently is the typical way these tools work, which is that they produce a data flow graph. So if we have this, here's our data flow graph. We have adders and a result, and this is sort of what you'd want to do to like do the single cycle version of this computation. And then they take that and they schedule it, given some constraints. So a realization with two add functional units would be that, say, that in our first cycle, we're going to do the first two adds. In our second cycle, we're going to do the next one. With one, a possible schedule is in our first cycle, we'll do that add. In our second cycle, we'll do this one. And then we'll produce the final result in a third cycle. So we take this data flow graph here, which is something we conceptually do in a single cycle, but we aren't going to make our processor big enough when this is produced from a whole program. And we split it up so we can have these functional units that we use across multiple cycles. So conceptually, we have a little custom instruction set where we're going to specify which phase we're in, which inputs you get. And the circuit realization you might get for that might be something kind of like this, that we have, somehow we get the inputs, details omitted about where they're actually stored, and we have a result that we're going to send out that will only be actually correct at the appropriate cycle. And here's our one adder that we're going to share between the computations. So we have some storage for these values. And what I'm not showing on this diagram is that there's going to be some control logic that's going to decide, when do I enable writing into this register? So, and which of these inputs into the muxes do I actually send to the output? So during the first cycle, we want to add, say, A plus B. The control logic is going to send a signal to this mux to select A and output it, and select B and output it, and to enable writing on this register. And in the next cycle, to add C and D, it's going to send D an output and C an output and enable writing on that register. And so on. And finally, in the third cycle, we'll take the outputs of these registers and then through the mux add them and produce our results. So that's very simple control logic relative to something with a real instruction set. Because conceptually, there are three instructions, which are add AB, add CD, and add A, B, C, D. So you just need a counter, basically, to figure out what you're doing, and you know what order you do that. So this is relatively simple to realize, and this is sort of usually the sort of design those tools are aimed to produce. And this is very different than maybe what your natural way of thinking about this if you're writing RTL by hand, but it's a natural way of translating from these C code. To this, yeah.
Some similar papers in the FPGA world, at least. I'm not sure about other ASIC papers, but some similar papers in the FPGA world propose a one-to-one correspondence between elements of data program and actual hardware. So then, that's how a lot of that's how a lot of high-level synthesis tools work, at least for the FPGA.
The one-to-one meaning?
Yeah, so if you go back to your data flow graph, on the left figure, each of those adders each of those pluses will actually be an adder.
So they just produce this full graph.
Yeah.
And they do that for every function or something like that?
Yeah.
Yeah. So in which case, your tuning, presumably, is also going to be how much can I fit on my ASIC or FPGA? And I need to divide that into units manually. My understanding is that is also part of the tuning people actually do, is specify, hey, I have a loop here. How much do I actually want to do in one cycle? Yeah, so there's simpler approaches where you just assume the users have done this before you, and you don't try to do this. So this is the sort of model that Aladdin is assuming that synthesis tools follow. That you take some version of this graph and somehow divide it into one, between one cycles or over multiple cycles and figure out how to use functional units. And they assume the functional units are enough work that they're what you care about. So Aladdin does something a bit different than the most general case, is that they use a dynamic data flow graph. So what's the difference between a dynamic data flow graph and a non-dynamic one? So why does this matter? Or what is actually the difference, like definitionally?
I guess for dynamic, you have access to runtime information.
So like, what's an example of the runtime information we're going to have?
Maybe if you get some kind of data and it satisfies some condition, you want to run it on one part of the hardware rather than another part?
Yeah, so if we have if statements in general, if we have conditions, then what Aladdin works with is that we have, so why? So if we have some code like this, where z is either w plus y or w, and then we say, you know, let's see, we are, what?
This is IO dependent, because if you knew these were constants, you could determine it static.
Yeah, well, and maybe you can, yeah, determine it statically anyways. But for example, given this code, maybe we run this side of the if else. And in that case, we have a different, I guess I should do something like, we don't depend on y. So the dot graph we're going to get if we run this side of the if else is going to be W is a dependency, W and X are a dependency of R. So we do W and X times, and that goes into R. That's the graph we're going to get. We aren't going to need to deal with like the synthesis tool that actually produces a real circuit that you actually might have a case where you need W and Y first. And then you get X. You have that sort of possible dependency there. So with the general synthesis tool, they're going to have less flexibility in how they schedule it because they need to reason about what happens in the if statement and somehow produce the control logic that's most efficient. And that turns out to be challenging, and how you actually do that is more of a compiler's issue. I'm not saying it's impossible to like do control logic that does the right thing, but a consequence of this is that we might have false dependencies, that maybe we could do this calculation of y later in general, but because of the way we're doing this, we're going to say, before we compute R, Y must be computed. And we might encode that in our hardware. And that sort of encoding in the hardware is a reason why these high-level synthesis tools need tuning, is to make sure that they don't do that, if that's often something you don't need to do. And there's other cases where they're going to have conservative assumptions. A bigger example is in memory. They need to assume that all memory access is conflict, right? Unless you tell them otherwise. So the sort of trick Aladdin is doing is that they're assuming someone will figure out how to get rid of that idea that we need to wait for Y to compute R. If that usually doesn't come up. That someone will figure that out when they make the control logic. And who is actually going to be responsible for doing that? What's the model Aladdin has for when that happens? Does anyone remember what they did to validate their predictions? So, big thing they did is that they actually generated tuned high-level synthesis code by hand for the problem and synthesized that and tested it with a simulator that works basically at the transistor level to compute power. And in the extended version of the paper that I didn't have you read because I felt you preferred the shorter one, they have this graph on what the impact for their problem, or I think this is FFT, one of their problems of doing the tuning in the C code, they patched the high-level synthesis tool in order to tell it about, you know, this dependency isn't real. You don't actually need to compute that first, even though it could have conflicted because of something in a memory or because of a conditional. And this was their alleged impact on sort of the performance they got. And the big problem, they said, was loops. So with loops, if you can't prove the two loop iterations are independent, even if you unroll the loop, you're going to have extra dependencies. And those are apparently hard for these tools to eliminate automatically, consistently, because sometimes they're real dependencies. That was their big complaint. So given Aladdin, an overlapping set of authors set to accelerating neural networks. So who here has heard of neural networks? Who here? Yeah. So, and some people haven't. I will give my brief overview, and I apologize for the people who actually know about neural networks for how brief this is going to be. So the basic idea of a neural network is that we're going to take some inputs and produce an output. And the idea is that the real world has some function that we want to of these inputs that produces a real output that we want to imitate. So there's some function of these inputs that's a real world output, and we're going to compute an approximate one of that, and we're going to compute these intermediate values, which I'm calling A and B here, which are neuron values in the terminology of neural networks, in order to do that. And the dependencies are shown with these arrows. So we take all the input values and use them to compute the intermediate values. So we're going to somehow incorporate the data for all the input values into all the A's, and the data from all the A's into all the B's, and the data from all the B's into C, and so on. And by having these multiple layers, the idea is that we can represent a very, very large class of functions well. So one way of thinking about neural networks is that they're general function approximators. That given that there's some real world function, we can approximate it pretty well by changing just exactly how we compute the intermediate values in a relatively simple way to basically compute any possible function. And an example of a way you might compute these intermediate values is, let's say, A1. We'll have weights, these W's, that will multiply times each of the inputs. And we'll just add them together and pass them to some threshold function, which is called an activation function. And basically, this function is just going to say, is this greater than a threshold or not? We're going to produce something which is approximately Boolean. It's not actually going to be Boolean because that turns out to be really bad mathematically, but it's basically going to be Boolean, sort of something Boolean-like. We're going to say yes or no. And for the later layers, it's the same idea, but instead of using the inputs, we use the values from the previous layer. And somehow, in a process I'm not going to describe, which is basically just minimizing something using calculus, but we're going to choose these weights to be the best possible approximation of a real function based on some samples we have. So what those, one of those individual values are, and what the majority of this accelerator is spending its time computing, are the values for these neurons, where we take, where we have a, we add some of these weights and then apply an activation function. And the example of an activation function would be this. This is sigma. There are other choices, which might be better for computationally, especially, since that's a pretty scary function to actually compute exactly. But the sort of idea is that this is almost like a zero or one. So around zero, it's like about half, one half. As you approach negative infinity, it basically becomes zero. As you approach positive infinity, it becomes one. But it's smooth, and that's important because it makes it differentiable, which means we can actually use calculus, which is very important if you actually want to find minimums and things like that. So any questions about my 1 minute tutorial on how neural networks work? So happily, this paper also wasn't dealing with how you actually train these networks beyond that they used a library to do it. So their sort of overall goal was to evaluate these neural networks. Given that someone has given us this list of weights, or a way to compute these list of weights, we're going to want to train a model once, and then be able to deploy it. Their notion is in portable devices. So their conceptual use case is like you train a handwriting recognizer once, and now you can make a really efficient chip that does your really awesome handwriting recognizer and put it and ship it with your cheap device that everyone can have. And it's really efficient, really low powered, won't run out of battery, and you didn't need to use an expensive general purpose chip. So that's sort of the problem they were going for. And so people had a lot of complaints in the paper reviews about, you know, like, is this actually worth doing? So what? Any thoughts on, is this worthwhile or not? Is there like a real use case for doing this?
Well, they said IoT, so I could imagine if there's a situation when, say, you want handwriting recognition in a little pen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I thought that it's the way that Internet of Things, I think, is headed is that, you're not just going to have these devices that are standalone. You're always going to be relying on some kind of computing backend in order to do things. So, customizing every single device so that it can take advantage of whatever some backend system would provide isn't that efficient, I don't think.
Okay, so one thought is that it's weird that they're targeting getting it really efficient on the device when often we just offload it to a more powerful device where the power concerns are not so tight. Any thoughts on the costs involved? Yeah.
So ASIC takes on the order of tens of thousands to billions of dollars to develop.
Okay.
So it seems a little wasteful, especially because they're not runtime programmable.
Okay. So what your concern is that it's not. So it's not really programmable, that they're very fixed function. So if you change your mind about what sort of neural network design you want, you are limited in flexibility. I don't think it's as bad because they built something which accommodated a variety of networks at least and tested that. But there's sort of a limitation here that you are devoting effort. So you point out like the obvious costs based on your cost estimate of like producing an ASIC, but one thing I like to think about is what do you think the cost in labor here are versus programming? a server that solves this neural network. So what did they do as far as research people? What did they do that's particular to neural networks here that took development time? So is any of the work they did reusable? If say I discover I don't want to make a neural network chip, I want to make a chip that does some sort of a specialized variant of FFT. If I decide that, how much of their work can I reuse? Yeah.
Didn't they do this kind of long lead analysis where they would select what aspects of the program to optimize for power in exchange for accuracy? So one of the things they choose fit with, so various data structures or like all of that could be used for making any kind of circuit.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so we had something. So one of the things they were doing was changing precision. And that's a very weird thing to do. So with neural processors, you don't think about it because you can't really do it. You have like maybe two choices, but the precision you can get. You can get single precision float and double precision float and maybe and integers of word size. Usually you can use smaller, but it's not worth it. It's the same speed. And there's a real benefit to having that flexibility. So this is a graph from a different neural network accelerator paper from the same conference on the accuracy they got with the neural network they were testing, and also energy. Energy is the blue bar for doing 32-bit float, 32-bit int, 16-bit int, 8-bit int. So if you can decrease precision, if somehow you can figure out that that's acceptable for your computation, you can save a lot of power. And FPGAs and ASICs have this extra flexibility that we don't have a functional unit with a fixed size. That we can do 10-bit integers everywhere, and that's actually a thing that's not hard. But in a CPU, that would be actually a pain to actually use 10-bit integers and get the power benefits from that. But here, we can do that. And you save enormous amounts of power if you can drop off this precision. And that is actually a relatively generic technique. Surprisingly, it's not something that's really automated in tools like Aladdin. It seems relatively recently that the architecture community is really exploring it well. And there are some problem-specific parts in figuring out how much can you drop. But you'll notice that they were exploring lots of parameter space. So like each of these dots represents them doing some computation about what configuration could you use. So if you're willing to do that, you can. You maybe don't need to know too much about the algorithm. You're willing to spend a lot of compute time saying, how good are things if I drop this many bits? And this is a real benefit. This is sort of like functional unit benefit. You also get benefits from making data storage smaller. So that's another big benefit of decreasing precision. Decreasing precision means you can also decrease the amount of data you store for things like weights or any values you actually need to store semi-permanently in memories. That can having that be smaller can really decrease your power consumption. So that was sort of one of the techniques they had, which is pretty generic. You can imagine almost not any problem, but many problems that deal with data from the physical world are going to be of the sort where your input data is imprecise anyway, so you can tolerate a certain amount of imprecision in the calculation. And when we specialize hardware, we can actually get big gains by figuring out how much imprecision we have. So were there anything besides arithmetic precision and the number of bits they had in values that was sort of kind of generic? Yeah.
You mentioned changing the supply voltage of SRAM.
Yeah, so they had this cute trick where they decided, you know, that we want to run the SRAM in this danger zone. So here's the fault rate. This is a log scale. And this is a very sharply decreasing line in a log scale. So here. So we see that, you know, we start out where if you supply the, if you supply the correct amount of voltage, our fault rate is really low. It's below 10 to the negative 6. But they wanted to operate in a region where your fault rate started getting higher, where like 0.01% of the time you have an error, and that's pretty scary if you're storing, you know, more than 10 to the 6 values by a large margin. So they wanted to run the SRAM in a region where you would have faults. And the SRAMs are where they're storing things like their weights. So these are important to the computation and dramatically affect computation. And if you are really concerned about accuracy, you typically would say, we're never going to even approach this, you know, one in every 10,000 times, 100,000 times we produce the wrong value, you know, because then you're typically going to produce a very wrong answer. But they wanted to run in this because they're saving power. So instead of running at like 8 volts, they're running at 0.7, and the power is proportional to that and how much space the SRAM takes up. And it turns out, though they didn't show it very clearly, that the SRAM is a lot of their area. Something like 40%. So that's a lot of their power is in the SRAM. And this is often true. This is true on CPUs. In CPUs, our SRAM is our cache. And the cache is usually most, or at least the plurality of the area of the core, of the chip, is caches. And the same often ends up being true on these accelerators, that most of the area is some sort of memory. So this is also generically a typical technique. It's just trying to increase this failure rate to save power. What did they need to do in order to make this actually work? Could you just run this with a high failure rate? What's the problem? Or this, what's make that scary to do, for even for these accelerator things where we know we can tolerate some numerical imprecision? So the question is really about, so these are these weights here that we're using for the computation. So the question is, what's the worst that could happen if we have an error in one of these weights?
Well, the output is completely wrong.
Yeah, so we could get the value completely wrong. We could, by making this weight large enough, and if it's possible to make it large enough or small enough, we can pretty much guarantee a particular value for any neuron in the system. And hypothetically, it could be the case that what the network we've trained really, really depends on a particular neuron's value. So for example, maybe we have a bunch of weights in the first row, and then in the second layer, B1 has weight 1 for A1 and 0 for everything else, and C1 has weight 1 for B1 and 0 for everything else. That's possible. Whether it's likely or not, who knows? But that's a real concern here, is that we're going to have these cases where maybe we're really sensitive to one change, where one change can cause a huge difference in our output. So what were some ways that you could, or that they did, you know, try to control the effect of this problem?
Did you mention something about training the neural network to detect failures or something? Does that mean?
I don't recall that. If you know more specifics, let me know. So, also part of their solution was a hardware thing. So one of the things they got from the hardware, that they relied upon eventually, is that they wanted to be able to detect when the SRAM was broken most of the time. So they had their high failure rate, but most of the time the failure would not be just you silently get the wrong bits. The failure would be that you know you get a signal saying, yeah, you write a value which is probably wrong. So one of the things they did to model this effect, though, is purely on an algorithmic perspective, they just answer the question empirically, what happens if we introduce random errors into our neural network? What happens if we randomly change one of these weights? How did the predictions change? So they did that analysis. That's a generic analysis you could do, but you really want to do it because you know, it could be the case that your typical neural network was very dependent on that. Turned out it wasn't. But we can certainly imagine that being the case. And for another problem, you'd certainly want to check, like, what actually happens if I change these numbers? So there's something else they did with this information about whether the hardware had actually failed. And that was that they said, okay, we at least don't want the error to cause a big change in our results most of the time. So the big problem with neural networks when you have a big change is if you accidentally write a weight as a really, really big weight. Because most of the weights in the neural network are not really big. Most of them are kind of small. So that meant what they did is if they detected an error, they wanted to somehow read a lower value. So they either would read a zero for the weight instead of the real value when there was an error. Because at least a zero is less likely to cause computational problems than it reading some random large value. Like, it's still going to produce the wrong answer, and if you're in the unlucky case where you're reading, you're supposed to read a large value, which is a minority of the values in the network, then it might be a large error. But usually this is going to make the error pretty small. So the sort of generic version of this is you want to replace, when you can't read a value from memory, you want to detect that with their technique and replace it with something like a typical value. Happens with neural networks that a typical value is one that's close to zero. Okay. And I guess we skipped over sort of the general design. So their general design, since they were working on this sort of notion of functional units in a pipeline, is that they had a bunch of pipelines which looked like normal, like kind of like a processor pipeline. Just looks kind of like a processor pipeline, except these phases aren't fetch, decode, execute. They're fetch activation, fetch wait. Do the multiply the weight and the value and all that. Compute the activation function. But the steps are steps of the computation, but otherwise it looks like a normal processor pipeline. And they had each of these data paths, they just had them in parallel. And one of the parameters they had, besides these algorithmic optimizations, was how many of these do you have? What does the pipeline look like? So they had all these trade-offs. So they had some of these algorithmic trade-offs. So one of which was very, very problem-specific. So in designing neural networks, you actually have a lot of choices about how many layers you have, how big each layer is. So they explored all those choices. So that was a very problem-specific piece of work that had to be done, is integrating that exploration with the hardware trade-offs it requires. So that was something that was labor they had to do, which is not really reusable for other problems. Then they dealt with all the things about precision and faultiness. That was sort of a mathematical trade-off, which has effects on the hardware. And then they also looked at these parameters about how much parallelism you have, which is just sort of generic things that happen when you're making something that looks kind of like a processor. And when they explored each of these, they basically did the dumb thing. They just said, we have a lot of simulation time of some sort, so we're going to test a lot of these. So for the neural network parameters, they just built hundreds, maybe thousands of neural networks, figured out what the accuracy was in their tests, and they got what they call a Pareto frontier. So a Pareto frontier means that you can't improve performance without hurting something. You can't improve one parameter, like the prediction error, without increasing the number of weights, in this case. So that's the general shape they're looking for, so that you'll have this Pareto frontier where you can't improve the parameter without hurting something else. And you definitely want designs which are always on this frontier. And they did the same exploration for the various hardware parameters, like amount of parallelism in the hardware. And you get the same sort of frontier between power and execution time. So they choose a degree of parallelism which gets on this line here, and it depends on how fast you actually need to be versus how much power are you willing to spend. So I think they chose this point, but there are other choices, and you produce this data by just simulating a lot of things, which is why they really cared about making a fast simulator, so they could actually do all these possibilities and get results quickly without implementing each of them as something they could actually make a full processor from. So there was something else they did, which was kind of funny. So they had this sort of brute force exploration for these parameters of hardware parallelism and the neural network parameters. They had a kind of a different notion for how they dealt with the precision. Does anyone remember how did they decide how much precision to drop? What was the sort of overall goal they had when doing that? It's related to this graph. So they had this notion that there was some intrinsic error in the neural network calculations. That they looked at, they trained multiple neural networks, and they had some variation in their performance, and that was intrinsic. And what they decided to do, which I felt was a little weird, is that they said, for things like decreasing precision, our metric is going to be, when we decrease the precision, we want to not increase error above this intrinsic variation. On the assumption that that must be tolerable because it's the variation between different trainings of the network. I'm a bit puzzled that they didn't decide, maybe we should consider this one of our parameters and look at the Pareto optimal, including it, but they didn't do that. So, any other comments on the papers today? Yes?
Sure. So, for the Aladdin paper, they mentioned something about their speed up being 100 times faster. What were they actually comparing it to? That it's RTL design flow.
So, my assumption is that they were comparing to the time for placing and routing a full chip.
Manually?
With a high quality automated tool, and then running that through a system, through an actual transistor level power model. that was the impression I got. It wasn't as clear as it could be, but I think that's what they were doing. So the Atlantic paper, they're comparing to you that you have, you get the RTL file, and then you, produce a gate list, turn that into something which you can actually turn into a chip, which means you need to say, hey, where do all these components go on the chip, which turns out to be computationally intensive, especially if you went to actually minimize area. And I guess in real processors, for scarily, my understanding is that many companies do this by hand, a lot of it by hand. It's apparently very high-skilled labor-intensive, great employment for EE majors, but probably shouldn't be done that way.
You're typically placing out small blocks, and then the compiler will put the bigger ones together for you.
Yeah.
But at the very large scale, where you're connecting components like the CPU itself with some L1 cache or something, then that's, again, done by hand. So it's sort of the middle that's...
So the hand-done part is kind of a tribute to this multi-hour figure?
I assume that because they're academics, they are doing nothing by hand. That they have they're assuming they have a functional unit library, which might be placed and routed by hand for the functional unit. But other than that, they're probably not. If you've seen photos of placed and routed academic, well, pictures of placed and routed academic chips, they are often very obviously not done by hand at all. Like, they have, I should find one sometime. Like, they'll show you a picture of like here are the regions of the chip. Looks like that. Probably didn't get those shapes by actually designing this. They probably just used a tool which put the gates on the chip somewhere, and they got these funny shapes of each of their pieces. So my assumption is they didn't, but it's not clear from the paper. But I assume the design flow, I assume they're just measuring the actual compute time and not human time, just because it's hard to consistently quote human time at that sort of scale. So, any other comments on the papers? Questions? Okay, so the other topic we should probably bring up today is homework 3. So, I hope everyone has started on it because it's due tomorrow. The first part should be done tomorrow. So, are there questions?
Oh, it's tomorrow.
The first part should be done by tomorrow at 11:59. No. Should be tomorrow. That's what I have it in Prolab. That's what I meant. So any questions about the homework? Yes.
I have a question about the answers.txt file.
Yeah.
So there's sort of two parts. There's one where you report the average total of the times.
Yeah.
And then there's the bottom time where you want us to report the total runtime results.
Let's pull up the homework so I have a reference for this properly. Okay. Yeah.
If you go to the section on answers,
Okay. Yes.
Yeah. So is the kernel 1 y dot y over y the same as the y dot y over y you would use in problem 1 total GPU runtime section?
Yeah, I believe it should be.
Okay.
Yeah, I believe these should be the same numbers.
Okay.
And for these numbers, I mean, it shouldn't just be one number, but it should be and the confidence interval, like plus or minus. Whatever you get. There's a question on Piazza about how many runs you need to do. Usually you assume when you produce confidence intervals that things are approximately normal, which is always wrong, but usually not too wrong. And given that, probably 5 or 10 is enough. 3 is cutting it kind of close. And if you try with 1 or 2, your typical estimates of confidence intervals will be plus or minus infinity, and that is not acceptable. I don't need to learn that the runtime is between 0 and infinity. Other questions on the homework? Yes?
This is translated for large problem size, not like.
Yes, you should. I would recommend, doing like 10 or 16 million. Yes. Please do not concern yourself with the runtime for like 1,000, because we need to talk to a thing which is off the processor. It's never going to be worth doing that. For a relatively simple computation on 1,000 values, or even a kind of complicated computation on 1,000 values. So we only really care about the performance with that. Also, the code we've given you uses a microsecond timer, so if it takes less than a microsecond, or about a microsecond, we're not going to get good results. Right, and I should mention there's a second part. So I've posted some codes which I have tested locally, and that's it, which are just serial implementations of these for reference that include code which should verify your answer. And I'll go briefly over what these problems are. So the forward substitution problem, I have them in that order? I do. Weird. So the forward substitution problem is that I'm solving A times X equals B, where A is a lower triangular. So the top part of the A matrix is 0. And that means what I'm going to do is I like have 2, and X is what I'm solving for, and like 7. I know that 2x1 equals 7, so x1 equals 7 over 2. And then I'm going to go to the next row, and I might have like 3, and I apologize that over this side of the room it must be impossible to read this, 3 and 5, and I have 3x1 plus 5 equals, say, 8, and I'm just going to substitute this 7 over 2 in there somehow, do the calculations that effectively do this. This turns out to be simpler when you do it. 5x2, and subtract that from this, and solve it for x2. And I'm going to go down, and this is called forward substitution because we substitute the values we've already found as we go down the matrix. This is a step in the real world of how we solve the general case of ax equals b. So the usual way of solving that is to do something called an LU decomposition, where we divide represent A as multiplying two matrices, one of which looks like this and the other of which has it looks like basically the opposite, and then solve iteratively to get the solution. And the problem I've given you, the code I have, instead of this being X, it's multiple X's and multiple B's, but the same idea. We're doing multiple in parallel. Okay, the second option is breadth first search. So breadth first search means that we take a graph. I will reuse this one, for example. So if we're doing a breadth-first search starting at W on this graph, we'll search W, and then we'll search these two times, and then we will search here. And the idea is that you want to produce what is called a breadth-first search tree. So if we're starting at W, we want to produce this graph here. Just the things we visited to do the search. So note that the edge between these two is not in there, because we didn't visit it to do the search, and we don't visit any node twice. And every node is at its the distance of the shortest path from W, where we started. And basically, the way you're going to do this in parallel most easily, there's multiple ways, but the sort of most straightforward thing is that we have a list of all the edges out of W, and you can go through that in parallel and mark each of these nodes and say, remember, oh, the parent of this is W. So the data structure you'll actually produce is for every node, it is like W is for every node, what is its parent? And I also have some code to actually check the results of that, which is not straightforward because there are multiple correct answers for some graphs. Because there's sometimes there's two ways to get to a node at the same two ways to get to a node with the same number of steps from where you start. And I have some graphs on a temporary direct in a folder that's on the cluster that are pretty large for that. And of interesting structure. Yes?
Good question. Part 3.1 of request, can you make it so we can have multiple submissions on part 3.1? I submitted the incorrect version. I forgot the plus or minus.
I thought I did already, so definitely. I intend to always have allow resubmission enabled. So the other problem is 2D convolution. Here the idea is that we take a graph of image, I should say, sorry, an image represented as a matrix, and we take each element of it, take a neighborhood around each element of it, and multiply it element-wise by a template, which we'll call, say, a filter. So we multiply this by the first corner, this here, and we just add those all together, and we get a single value. And we do that over the entire matrix to get a new matrix. So there's some examples of what this means pictorially for images, which is where this problem basically comes from. So you apply this take this window over the image, and for each possible place you could put the window, you apply that multiplication. So you multiply everything together and add up the values, and that produces your new value and your results. That single value based on that template. Applies across the image, and probably the nice nasty part is that on the corners of the image, we want this to actually produce a sensible result. And what you're going to do is that if we have a value x here, we want you to pretend that the value x extends off the end of the image. And if you have a value y here, we want you to pretend that it extends off the end of the image. And I'm sure that's probably the most annoying part of an efficient 2D convolution to implement well. Not the most performance important part, but definitely the most annoying to write correctly if you don't want it to make everything slow. So that's the 2D convolution problem. So any questions about these potential problems for part 2? I mean, I'm sure you might have some later. After you've thought more about it. So hopefully this gives you enough information to at least decide which one of these you want to do. And if you don't want to do any of these, you're welcome to propose your own problem, but you need to clear that with me. I'm likely to be very generous. I just expect you to have a way of checking the answers on your problem and that it's like actually feasible to do and not super, super trivial. Like, you should not propose like a vector sum. That or vector max, that would also be unacceptable. But these aren't like particularly complicated. And I would accept anything, especially if you have an actual practical use for it that will convince me it's not trivial easily. So please do that early because I don't want to be frantically deciding whether to accept your problem 3 days before this is due. It's not good for any of us. So, yeah. Just let it in. And so one little note before I leave today. So some people have a habit of putting text from papers in their paper reviews. So I don't recommend this. But if you want to do this, you need to do this in a way which is academically honest, and it's some people are not doing this well. So I understand that maybe you feel like the paper said it better than you, and that often is true. Maybe. But you need to make it really obvious that you're when you're quoting the paper. And this includes cases, which is think it's not what's getting to people, where you take little phrases from the paper and you'll put them in a different way. If there's a substantial amount of text in common between what you wrote and what's in the paper, even if it's not together in the paper, that is not acceptable. That in other contexts, people are going to consider that plagiarism. So you need not to do that. I would note that usually you're better off rewriting it completely. Yes, even if your grammar is horrible, you're still probably better off writing it completely. You know, just having a consistent style in what you're writing, with consistent terminology for everything, which doesn't come up when you take a little phrase because from the paper doesn't do it. But if you are going to quote, you should like use quotes and make it very clear that what text you wrote, what phrases to describe things you wrote, and what you didn't. So that's just my note on this. And I'm sorry for not noticing this much earlier, but we weren't paying as much attention to like reading the paper reviews in detail earlier in the semester than we should have. Okay. So right. So I wrote a closing note. So there were other papers on this topic, and if you actually want to read a paper about neural network accelerators, EIE, which is from the same conference, is probably a better paper. I didn't choose it because I felt this paper explained the generic trade-offs better. So that paper was also focused on neural networks, but a lot of what they were doing, it was less obvious how you'd apply that to a different sort of problem. In particular, their bigger gain was having a sparse representation of the weights, which this paper didn't focus on. But that's very particular to that the neural network-like problems. And it's not as clear how that extends to other things. I just chose this paper to read just because I felt it was a more generic technique, but as far as quality work, you should look at more papers. You know, it's not a matter of opinion which one is better, but there are other papers on this topic. It's a very hot topic. And this might not be the best one. It's not why I chose it. I chose it because things like reducing precision is a general thing that this paper talks about better. And apparently there's something going on in this room soon. So next time, we're going to talk about warehouse scale computers. I have reading on the schedule and no paper review for it because it's not the sort of reading that lends itself to a paper review, but I think this is good reading. So there's a book called The Data Center as a Computer, which you can get online. Through the library. It has chapters. I've chosen some chapters to read. It's about building data centers. And that's what we'll talk about next time. And the big thing that's different about data centers, and one of the chapters I say to read, which is chapter 6, is that they really care about cost. And not just the cost of buying the hardware. They really care about operational cost. Which is not really something we've seen before. And I think that's my opinion, that's the most important thing to learn. But there's other things which are going on in data centers which are very different than what we've seen in other large computing environments. And as a further preview, so next week we're going to talk about security. So next week, the next paper review is in before Thanksgiving. It's in the last is about protecting programs from people manipulating hardware. And we might also touch on these other things a little bit. And after that, my expectation is to just do exam review in the week after Thanksgiving. And I'll send out around before Thanksgiving, I will try to send out what exam topics do you want me to cover? do you think you might need one a refresher on, or maybe first course for some things I thought were undergrad topics? Okay, that's all I got.